there's a real temptation for medium to larger organisations to pick up a suite of template answers or policies that they think will be great for business continuity and incident response plans specific to cyber, whatever it is, but not really incorporate it.
This is GamyCast.
As a primary target for ransomware campaigns,
is security and testing and performance and scalability.
Risk and compliance.
We can actually automate that.
Take that data and use it.
Joining me today is EJ Wise, founder and principal of Wise Law. And today we're discussing preparedness specific to a cyber breach. So EJ, thanks for joining the show and welcome.
Thank you so much. A real pleasure to be here.
Okay, so you and I did the sit-down session recently in the studios. I really liked what you had to say. I liked your directness, your frankness, and I really value people that speak their mind, that have an opinion. So thanks for sharing that, and that's why I wanted to bring you on the show, because you raised some really great points, but then also speaking with you afterwards, we sort of carved out the angle for this show. And I really want to get into the details of this because this stuff is important around it. So I want to explore that a bit more. So what does that mean for you specifically?
Oh, thanks so much. Yes, mutually very much enjoyed our sit down and the argy-bargy that ensued thanks to you and that term. I cannot understand the mindset that we will prepare for bushfires, we'll prepare for floods, we'll prepare for earthquakes, and yet all of us are connected, or no matter your age group, really, we're all connected. We know you cannot pick up a paper or look at any social media news site and not see the latest breaches. How is it a shock that cybersecurity is a problem, that people are being, you know, breached morning, noon, and night? And yet the preparedness isn't there. This one maybe was being too long in the military where they exercise. But I think there's some really simple, cost-effective, free even steps that people can take to be prepared.
Yeah, you raise a great point. Totally hear with, you know, your side of things when you're saying like about bushfires and all those, you know, those sort of catastrophic events that do occur. Would you say, though, that people are aware that this is a thing, but maybe they're not really sure on how to get prepared?
Absolutely, yes. And I realise it can almost sound trite of me to say get prepared and then not follow up with how do you do it. You need to target this for the audience. So it's very different whether we're speaking to individuals in Australia, to small businesses in Australia, to, you know, SMEs, medium-sized businesses, large corporations, their level of preparedness clearly has to be different. There's a real temptation for medium to larger organisations to pick up a suite of template answers or policies that they think will be great for whether it's business continuity, whether it's an incident response plan specific to cyber, whatever it is, and incorporate it into that organisation, but not really incorporate it. It doesn't, for example, speak about which state and territories it applies in. It might not list emergency contact details because it's a template and it hasn't been modified. And then even worse, if before anyone knows how to use it or they've exercised with it or trained with it, they try to implement it. They actually go, okay, we're now in situation X. We've got a ransomware. We've got a whatever it is. Pull out 12 templates, not know which one seamlessly or non-seamlessly fits into which, and really caught with their pants down. And when you're responsible as a director, when your stock, you know, exchange listed, there are real diligent duties that apply to you. It's not okay to say, well, I thought we had this covered. I think if you look around the physical location that you're in and there's a fire extinguisher sitting on the wall, someone's prepared that setting for a fire. Who's your cyber warden? How are they preparing that same setting for the far more likely event of a digital cyber event than a fire? How are they prepared?
Yep. Okay. So there's a couple of things in there. And you're right. I think it's probably because, and I mean, I'm speculating here, probably because you can't see cyber as much, whereas a physical fire, the whole house goes up in flames, pretty obvious, right? You've got to do something.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to go back a couple of steps. So you mentioned some free ways on how people get prepared. So can you give me an example or what are some free ways for people that can start this today? Because, I mean, a lot of these things are overwhelming. Everyone's got a list as long as their arm or two arms to get through everything. It's like, oh, I'm going to get, you know, got to get prepared. And much to your point, I'm a big proponent of, sure, if you're going to say get prepared, well, what are the answers? A lot of people come out and say get a plan, get cyber culture going. Well, what does that mean? So this is what I want to cover on the show. I want to get specifics. I want to get examples. I want to know what are the first 10 steps people should do. So maybe let's start with the free stuff and then we can dovetail into the more complicated side of things.
Yeah, sure. The free stuff is being organized. For example, let's say you and I are in an office and there's about 130 people in the building and some people work 3 days a week and some don't, some are remote. That's all fine. That day we're in the office. That day you and I turn up, we flip open the company laptop and are greeted with a sign that says ransomware. What's the free thing that I could have done before this occurred? I could have printed out the contact list for IT support and had it by my terminal. It could be, and a lot of organizations are hot desking now. If the system is down, and most systems are linked to the phone system now as well, what then? And it costs, well, okay, it costs a couple of cents to print something out. In the same way that I guess in the 80s and 90s we had a spate of people ringing and pretending there were bombs in organizations in buildings, we had that bomb threat checklist by the phone. I'm sure you recall it. Why aren't we thinking like that? Like, I want people to actually imagine I've walked into the building, I've gone in, I've sat at my desk, I've made a coffee, I've said hello to Norm and Steve and Barb, and then I've gone turn on and I've been greeted with something unexpected. It doesn't turn on or whatever else happens. What next? That doesn't cost anything to just know who is responsible in my organization.
So you said, why aren't people thinking like that? So why aren't people thinking like that then? Because you're right. And how you say it makes sense, but we're not doing that.
We're yet to develop the culture of it. And, you know, I think I may have mentioned in our sit down, it felt like when I returned to Australia in 2016 from living in the States for 8 years, it felt like a little bit sliding backwards in time for cybersecurity and technology. And that's not to say we're a backward country, but it's only recently that we've got a cybersecurity minister, for example, in the federal government. So I think there is a lack of culture around it and also first-hand lived experience. So I, you know, the imaginary workmates I have, Barb and Steve and Tom, whoever, do any of them have a lived experience of a cyber incident? Because it starts to change when someone you know firsthand has, and they can talk about it over the water cooler and say, oh, well, actually, when I was in my last organization, this is what happened. And they had a cyber warden and they had a blue plastic hat instead of the red fire warden hat. And you just went to them. But, you know, there was always a printout. Everyone knew it would be in the tea room or whatever it is. So I think it's no, definitely not a blaming game, but there's a lack of a lived experience of it. And a lot of the people who are in charge of organizations, whether they're directors, whether it's the C-suite, they're older than me or they're kind of my age. So some of these people grew up with typing pools, not with the internet, not with computers, not with laptop, not with IT, not with cybersecurity. And their view of the devices that they use, whether it's a standalone, whether it's a laptop or whatever, is that it's a tool almost like a typewriter. They're not seeing it as a device that's capable of capturing so much data about them and being used against them. So there's a mindset that's needed to understand and a culture shift that we are in a technological age. There was the Industrial Revolution. People have talked about the technological revolution, and we're not yet used to it. We're really used to fire and flood and earthquakes. They're not pleasant and they're outside our control. Well, cyber breaches aren't pleasant and they're outside our control to an extent.
Okay, so just so hypothetically, you're listening to the show, you're an executive director, CEO, whoever, board member. Would you then advise that if you do not have a printout of IT or whoever, the cybersecurity company you're leveraging, you should get that and then put it somewhere in your house at home? Is that what you're sort of saying? Like if you're someone of a level of responsibility, right? Because at the end of the day, yes, you can have stuff printed around the office, but you should still have that as like in a as an addendum to the stuff that's already in the office that's printed out, or people should have phone numbers of these things in their phone, etc., in their mobile phone.
Look, yes, because we are in this age post-COVID where people are doing a hybrid of working in the office and working at home. So even if the printout is in the office and that's how they are doing things, which is great, it might not be that you're conveniently at the office when you get the ransomware note on your screen. And yes, for example, if I'm ED in a corporation that sells widgets, I want to know the 5 to 10 most important clients. And if I can't access my device to ring those clients and say, you need to know production's going to be held up for 36 days. We've experienced a breach. It's not affecting your data, but it's going to affect supply. You needed to know that. You needed to know that in the hour. If you didn't have access to who those 5 to 10 most important customers were because you hadn't put your mind to it, not because you're evil, that's a problem. That's a problem for business continuity.
So would you say in your experience and what you've seen that there are people or organisations out there, if something were to happen, ransomware, whatever, they wouldn't have those 5 to 10 top customers in their mobile phone that they could contact to say, hey, we can't dispatch your stuff or X, Y, or Z. Would you say that that's the case?
Absolutely. People have people working for them. If they've now lost the most common means of communicating with that individual, so let's see, the ED speaks to one of the sales reps and goes, sorry, who were the five most profitable customers? Who was, so not just the people they have a personal relationship with. There are some very, very large organisations and the ED can't possibly know them all. How do I find those out? Oh, I'm sorry, I can't access that right now because my system's down too. It's just really simple common sense stuff. And I think that, when people go through an incident, response scenario where you're pretending it's happened, an exercise, that's where you start to realize I didn't have those ones. Or you know what, the list that I did have, three of those people changed their jobs in the last 6 months and I don't know the new points of contact. So this is work, right? It does take work to keep this updated. So the idea that you have preparedness is as simple as that, as cost effective as having a printout. And then it's ensuring that everyone on your team is on board with understanding this. So the number of times I go into a site and then find there's a policy and it says you need to do this with your passwords, you can't do that with your password. But, the post-it notes up on the screen of executives because they don't remember their passwords. I mean, physical security, as you will get, is a part of cybersecurity. If I can walk into a floor and pick up your password by actually walking past your monitor, you've just made my job so easy as a cyber criminal.
So what do you think rattles people the most from, in these incidents? Like it's something so basic as, oh, my goodness, I don't actually know who my top five customers are. I don't have their names and their numbers. Is it something like that that just completely throws people off of how much that they are vulnerable at that point, that you don't know the names or the contact numbers of these people that pay you the most amount of money in your mobile phone?
Yeah.
Do you think that rattles people the most?
Oh, it rattles them a lot. It rattles them a lot because if it's a widget that, for example, is supplying, let's say, the ICU tubing, so now a whole bunch of people having emergency or elective surgery won't have it because there's now a 3 to 6 day, week, whatever it is, pipeline delay. And I'm not yet touching the critical infrastructure legislation, but things have a flow-on effect. And so, yeah, you're having a very bad day when you can't communicate with them. But you may be having a worse day if you also don't have, for example, the insurance details somewhere outside your system. If you also don't have general counsel's details outside your system, because we're so reliant on the system and we expect it to work. And that's absolutely fine. You're not calling a cybersecurity lawyer in when things are going well, usually post-breach anyway. When I'm called in, things are going very not well. Very, very not well.
Okay, so you mentioned before, okay, all that stuff makes sense. So how often should people, as a pulse check, be updating their stuff? Like, give me an example. I know the answer is it depends, but from your experience, how often, like, is there something that prompts people to say, okay, now once a quarter we update it, or like, is there any sort of process that you follow from your experience?
Yeah, look, for the policies that I write for organizations, I automatically put in a 12-month review of the policy. So at the absolute slowest, I would look for the contact details while you're doing that policy review on whichever one it is, whether it's the business continuity plan or a disaster recovery plan or an incident response plan, you have that. But looking at the turnover of people in key positions, especially this last few years, I think 6 months is a lot more pragmatic. Any more frequent than that, it's very hard to do unless you have a dedicated person that can just be doing this. I think one of the other frustrations that I've seen in live incidents, but also scenario, is where the comms team, it comes as a surprise to a lot of people that the comms team had to work so hard. They didn't expect that they would need to have so much messaging out to internal and external stakeholders, for example.
Okay, so there's something that's really, you said that's really interesting there, the policy. Now, policy, schmolcy, only because, only, okay, but hear me out, EJ, because I've used this example before on this show. When you're driving on the road here in Australia and you're going to get 80, people go 90, they go 100, they get fined, right? So technically that's the road rules. People still break them. So how do you enforce a policy on every 6 months, Barbara and Jonathan need to update the phone contacts when they've got 50 other things to do, but it's in the policy that's in the back of some old school filing cabinet in, you know, in backyard Bob's barbecue equipment galore store. How does that work?
So if Barb and Bob are specifically responsible as part of their duty statement to just ensure that the policies are up to date, or specifically contact lists are up to date, that's part of their KPI and they haven't performed it. So yeah, that sounds to me more like an HR problem and maybe a morale problem, right? I think there's this link we make between policy is dry and really dull, and especially when it isn't actually modified to match the organization. If it's just some template that is, as you say, sitting in a dusty old filing cabinet, no one's relating to it, no one's read it, and they can't relate to it. So, you know, I find a lot of complexity. Some of the policies I pick up that other organizations, who I won't name, have drafted, they mean absolutely nothing to that organization. So it is about making it very relevant and inviting participation. So a lot less sort of mandating you will do this without engaging and helping people to understand. So when we do cybersecurity training, for example, in an organization, whether it's at the board level, whether it's out to all the people, it's none of the information that you give them doesn't apply to their personal lives. They go home and say, I'm going to tell this one about whatever it is, multifactor authentication, to my teenager who's at high school, because all of this stuff is relevant to their personal lives. So I think, unlike possibly some of the fire drills and things that we do in large organizations and offices, you know, or the annual equity training or whatever it is, where people can kind of roll their eyes, we shouldn't, but we do. This one applies to you, theindividual.com, wherever you are. Cybersecurity needs to be part of your existence, or it is already part of your existence, but you need to be aware of it. And so any training that an organization does to engage their people, whether that's at the end of the day so they make sure their policy is enforced, it's going to help the individual. Bring them on board. It's the journey that the organization's doing and it's not going to hurt the individual. It's actually going to help them.
And look, I'm just very practical and ask these questions. I've worked in bigger organizations like, oh, this is the policy. Do you think 9 people out of 10 know that policy? No, is the answer. Even the people enforcing it are like, oh, I don't even know what's going on here. Like, I'm very real, right? I've been on both sides. I've been on so many sides of the equation. Like, I'm not just going to sit there and say, I'm going to be really practical and straightforward around the reality is people probably don't really care at the end of the day, but you are right. It is part of their KPIs. Barbara and Jonathan, they're responsible for it. Then they have to own that a little bit more. I've just seen it so many times of, this is the policy. No one knew it, number one. And then even if we did know it, no one abided by it.
Yep. And so then we're talking about conversations, and you can't force employees to every lunch and learn, but a lunch and learn where the invitation is there and whether they get an extra credit towards or whatever, you know, organizations run things differently, but you come to the lunch and learn and they actually explain to you why is a long, strong password better? Because this is, you get it. This is one of the most basic things that we consistently get wrong as individuals, as humans, in our human experience, in the mammalian 1.0 OS. I think understanding why, and if I get them to look at a short video, for example, on a cyber criminal who's running a little algorithm, and they understand how simple Manchester 123 is, or your wife's name, or your dog's name, or the birthday, whatever. And just show how quickly, I mean, there's a website on, you know, how long will it take to break my password? And you can delight in thinking, okay, it will take over 100 years to break my password. That feels good.
Look, I'm a big proponent of why. That's why I do this show. I want to know why. I want to know every little inch of why. And it bothers me when people are like, oh, you should just do this, Katie. Well, why? And that's why I've never been great at corporate, because like, no, just do the thing. And I'm like, well, I don't get it. Like, why? And that's why I hated mathematics, because I'm like, yeah, but why is 3 3? And the teacher's like, just do it. What do you mean? Okay, so there's a couple of things. So you made a statement that say people, as in businesses, do nothing, then are somehow surprised by a breach. You mentioned it before and the comms people scrambling about what's going on. So I'm curious to see the journey around what this looks like.
Yep. So, for example, you and I are back in our imaginary office with the 150 other people, and it's a ransomware morning, and we've turned up to work, we've flipped open the screen, and there's the ransomware note. So, you know, we assume that people well above our pay grade are doing what they've got to do. And what are they doing? So they know it's happened. Who do they need to tell? I don't know. Insurers, they might want to speak to their IT team. All these conversations are happening. At what point of that day do you think you and I are going to get a message? Because it's darn well not going to come to us through our machine, is it? Because it's been ransomed. Have you and I been trained to know what to do with that? Have you and I taken out our personal device and taken a photo of it? Have we run home and said, oh, you're never going to guess, we've been ransomed? Are we helping or hurting the organization right now? Have we just tried to turn it on again? Are we jamming the phone lines by ringing IT when one of the first things it says is don't everyone ring IT at once? So, you know, getting people on board and understanding this is a system-wide error and getting the comms out. So is there an up-to-date phone number for everyone? Does the organization have an alternative contact route? Did they all used to use Teams and now they can't? Does everyone have a backup route, even if it's as basic as SMS and SMS chains or Signal or whatever it is? Because if so, you and I are now still, because we checked into the city that day, okay? We're in that physical office. We're waiting to know, because no one on our floor knows what's next. No one's had any comms. So let's go and take an eagle's view of the comms room right now, assuming there is a comms team. They are flipping out because they can't get comms out. They're being yelled at by C-suite or the board because there's stakeholders involved, there's media involved, there's the ransomware gang that need comms. And it turns out that in the latest bunch of redundancies, the comms team got halved in numbers and all the longest serving people that had the best intimate knowledge of that company are gone. And that's just the reality of where you're at. There's never perfect, but why wouldn't we just have, I don't know, the top 5 things of what to do if you see that, something that we have to hand as individuals as a play sheet.
So what would be your top five if you had to give an example? Notify people, actually know who works for you, number one.
In an ideal world, it's very hard once you're in the organization where there's...
Well, you got to think about it. If you got 50,000 people and you got no systems, how would you know who they all are? You wouldn't.
Well, this is it. So, you know, the military is very fond of breaking people down into groups and sections, and, you know, they're called commands, and then they'll be called, you know, troops, and then they're called flights, and then they're called sections. And in each section, there's only, say, a dozen to 15 people. And there'll be one section commander. That one section commander has everyone's phone numbers, okay? Then above the section commander, there's the flight commander, and he has all the section commander's phone numbers, right?
I like this. This is good. This is very logical in my books, yes.
I know, bless the military. It should only take one of the board, one of the C-suite, to SMS his little groupies of seven or so or 12, whatever it is, hey, ransomware incident notified on KB and EJ's floor at 8 p.m., 8 a.m., whenever we logged on. Go to action station 123 of plan 123. And the first part of that is they activate comms team and they all send out the, you know, the group commanders, the wing commanders, the flight commanders, the section commanders. And I apologize because I'm using Air Force kind of terminology. So everyone, so now you and I have been sitting at our workstations freaking out slightly. Usually the amygdala comes online and the frontal lobe goes offline when you see that. But you and I have now had a morning chat. We've had a cup of tea. And now an hour later, after seeing the ransomware note, the SMS has arrived from our section commander saying, do not speak to media. Don't ring home about this. Do not try to restart it. Catch a screen grab of what's on your screen right now. Write down the time that you first saw it and appear in the conference room at 10 a.m. for an update. And we go, oh, okay. All right, so we've got from 9 to 10 off. Let's go buy a muffin from our local and we'll learn more at that point. Just that amount of organization beforehand changes everything because you know what else? The second hit, it's the physical and emotional wear on those individuals. 24 hours later, if they still don't know anything, each one of them is a claim waiting to happen because you know that I started my legal career at Comcare Australia. A lot of compensation, right? You look after your people and having a dearth of knowledge, let alone for your customers, let alone all the stakeholders, look after your people. It's a really stressful thing.
And I guess the way in which you described it, like your troops, your flight commander in your terms, like that makes it not as overwhelming. I mean, if you're one guy and you're responsible for 50,000 people, like that's overwhelming. Like, but if you've got all these people that are, you know, making sure that their little group of people are fine and being informed, because what are the chances you and I are sitting in our imaginary office, I get the message and you don't?
100%. And then we've got our workstations close by. We chat to each other. You go, hey, did you get this? I say no. What do we know? How have we been drilled? How has our organization prepared us? Is it still okay for me to keep using the system? Or should I assume that everything I'm doing is being watched by the cyber criminal right now?
No, because then I'll say, sir, I think it must be a scam because you didn't get it, but I did.
Did you click on the link? Did you?
Yeah, exactly right. Like all of these things are very real scenarios. I'm not about fabricated, made up stories. I want to get into the realness of the reality of how these things go on. Someone doesn't get the message. Someone doesn't believe it. Someone, you know, had their phone on Do Not Disturb the whole day and missed the message. And then they've done something that they shouldn't have done because you didn't get the message and then you didn't inform me. Like it's a vicious cycle, right? Okay, so that's step number one. What about number two in terms of basic things? So you've talked about the five basic things. What's number two that you'd recommend?
I would recommend that every single person has a level of understanding about who is their person. So we've talked about up and down, and it's really understanding who am I responsible for, if anyone, and who's responsible for me. So it's an adjunct to point number one. And it means, oh, if this has happened, I know I need to tell these other people and I need to tell them this much. And it's about having that practiced. So that kind of leads to point three, which is have a plan. Point four is practice it.
Okay. I'm going to press on the practice side of it. What have you done a fire drill in your career? Yes, is the answer.
Many,
yeah?
Many. I've held the fire hose.
Okay, but okay, hold that for a moment, okay? I've been on level 57 in ML season and we have to walk down all the 57 stairs. You got people eating their Subway. You got a dude on the phone, whatever's going on. I probably wouldn't know what to do is the answer. So, yes, we can practice and go down the stairs and do this, that. But in a real fire, I'd be losing my mind probably, right? So this is where the practicing in from my experience of interviewing people across the globe on this show has been, yeah, but all of your logical senses go out the window. The whole building's burning down. You're not going, oh, let me get the printed document on the desk in the folder and go through it meticulously. You're in panic station. So how do you handle that? And I know it's not like what you say makes sense, but I'm also like mindful of I'm putting myself in the shoes of if there's a fire and I'm in the MLC center. Yeah, okay, I'm somewhat real and logical, but I'm also a human being, right? Like I've got feelings and emotions. I'm thinking I'm going to, you know, going to die in this building. Like all of those things go through your, you know, through your mind. So again, I'm trying to make it really practical because again, so many people have said, yeah, but you got to practice an IRP plan. Yeah, 100% you do. But when you're in an incident, you can't get into the building. You've got people screaming down the phone to you and you've got, you know, ASIC already calling you up and then your team is all over the place. That, all the methods, all the practicing goes out the window. It's something you can't really prepare for. So how do you handle all of that?
It's a great question. And I think the thing is, and certainly, you know, you speak to any army person, 5/6 of their career was on exercise. 1/6 was on actual wartime deployment. 5/6 of their time was practicing for war. So I'm not saying that we had the luxury in our day-to-day jobs of spending 5/6 of our time just preparing for a cyber incident. But what I would love, I would adore a mind shift that it's going to happen. Stop this if. You know, people come in wanting a will drafted and say, if I die, this is back when I was in the Air Force, and I'd look up at them and go, when you die.
If I die.
I want to write a will if really? I die. No, man, you're going to die. So I can't hand on heart look at any organisation in this country or any country and say you won't have a cybersecurity incident. So how about we just change this mind shift and mindset and go, when we have the next cyber incident, we'll be lucky if we know about it. Look at ANU. Look at ANU. They have two breaches in a row. The second breach, they would never have detected if they hadn't had the first breach and then put in some system. So if we're lucky, we'll know we've had this breach. And then we will have prepared. And how are we prepared? We don't have just stale policy sitting in a back drawer. We have something that people have put energy and time into and we've practiced it. And yes, it's not perfect. And I absolutely agree. Your frontal lobe is going to go straight offline, especially you know, the higher up you go in an organization, but not necessarily at every single level. The reality of a breach is horrific. And I've seen at some of the lower levels when it's happened, people just walking off, just completely unable to deal with what's happened and just walking off, which isn't an answer either. It's not helpful for anyone.
But I do understand that, right? It's overwhelming. It's stressful. You got people, you know, in your face and you don't know the answers. Okay, so all that makes sense. So if you, and again, on the, you know, 50 of your time, you're preparing for a war, understand that you can't do that maybe in a corporate sort of environment, but what would you recommend? Like how often should people be practicing? And what is, how do you practice? Because we can all sit there and read a document and a policy and do all that stuff, but how do we actually engender this is what you do when the thing happens? How do you enforce that? Now, I've worked for Westfield in the past. Every Tuesday, we called a toolbox meeting and we had to go through real scenarios, okay? I've had people come in with knives and all sorts of things, how you respond. And when those things were happening, which was daily, these all types of things would happen, I would know how to handle it because we're practicing every day. But these things were happening daily, which build the reps up. Now, cyber incident isn't always happening daily, okay? So people forget or it gets stale. What are the things or recommendations that gets people closer to, yeah, you're not going to be perfect, you're not going to be on your game, you know, you're not some SAS person out there doing this stuff all the time, but you're going to be better than perhaps maybe, I don't know, not practicing, but also practicing with more intention, perhaps.
Yeah, look, I think government probably does have this right. And I mean, state and federal, I've, you know, seen them exercise this about once a year. And the thing that comes out of it is following on from it. let's say they do the exercise in mid-year in June and they really realized there were some problems, that they identified critical vulnerabilities in their supply chain. They recognized that they were a critical vulnerability in other supply chains. And they also recognized they had ruined the comms team within 12 hours of the incident occurring. They were completely toast. So, you know, 3 months on from that, we'll say to them, why don't you just sit round and instead of, you know, getting an external organization, because when I'm coming in to do it, I'm an external organization, and that's part of the point. It's very hard to see what you look at every day. When you're on picket duty, in a weapon pit, for example, with a semi-automatic rifle, you are trained to look from right to left because we read from left to right, and you won't pick out the same things in the same way if you look the other way, if that makes sense. So if you're getting your own cybersecurity team or internal security or information team to do your drills, more likely to miss the stuff they see every day. So I'll come in with an external team. We're an external team. We come and do this with you. You pick up this, you know, a huge list of learning experiences. And then we say, look, in 3 months' time, you don't need to call us. You can. Just look at the latest three threats in the newspaper and pretend they happened that morning in your morning meeting. Just do that. Just do something. And as you actually mentioned the word reps, it is just like working out at a gym. Just keep that muscle active because you're going to need it and you don't know when it's going to happen. And we're never fully prepared, but you can be a little bit prepared.
And that's what I'm trying to get at. It's not like, you know, no incident's probably going to go perfect. It's just not going to happen. But you're going to be somewhat a bit better than on how do you get a little bit better, right? Like, and that, you know, going back to reps, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, they're like, oh, your interview. I was like, look, I've done so many interviews. That's because I'm doing the reps, right? If I can sort of relate it to what I do for my work, it's just doing the thing all the time. Gets easier. I've done it so many times. Versus when you first start doing interviews and stuff like that, it's very, very different. And it's the same sort of thing on just doing the time, doing the reps, showing up and practicing your craft.
Yes, absolutely. And the age of the board and the C-suite as I've described is, you know, they're in their 50s or older. This isn't familiar territory for them. But if I ask them to get into a, you know, a car, maybe a manual car, for example, and drive down the road, there's this, you know, behavior pattern in their brain. They don't even have to think about changing the gears and putting the clutch in because it's a, you know, it's an automatic thing to them. I want it to be a little bit more automatic for everyone in the entire organization. Because the other thing you don't know, and this also played out in the military, is how will people react under pressure? And it can be really alarming to see people who you've seen every day at work for, I don't know, 10 years, cool, calm and collected, that something like this happens and they absolutely lose their biscuit.
So how do you get a barometer to understand or get a sense of, you know, Barbara and Jonathan may lose their biscuit, even though they're very calm, cool and collected because they're KPI'd on the policy?
Every one of these incident responses that I've done, and actually whether they're real life or whether they've just been us going through a scenario, there's the same kind of cracks appear in the organisation. And I've already mentioned the comms team get absolutely hammered. And the takeaway I've had from all the real lives and all of the incident simulations are you can have some pre-prepared statements. You can already have approved by the board, basic media statement ready to go, which says organization X has been breached or has experienced an incident. At this stage, it's too early to know X, Y, or Z. They are looking into it. This is an information number, whatever it is. But it's such a basic, harmless statement. Why wouldn't that be in the toolkit for the comms team? Why are the comms team scratching at hour 10? From the incident happening at hour zero, why are they still scratching for board approval to even tell the employees in that organisation? These are things that they could have, I don't know, have 20 different versions of it if you want, because the comms team is just in every single scenario being hammered. The other thing that's been a real stress point for them was not understanding insurance policies for the non-government organisations that aren't self-insured. Not understanding that, for example, oh, this counted as social engineering. We don't have any coverage. We don't have any coverage.
Okay, so something else I want to ask you about, which is interesting. You say that people are surprised if they haven't prepared. Where does that come from?
I think it's part of this technology or slash failure to understand. And a lot of it comes from we've been using technology for so long. We've come to rely on it. We've come to expect it working. It is genuinely a shock when the appliance, your laptop, whatever, your smartphone, whatever it is, just doesn't function. It's a shock. It's the same as getting into your car in the old days, or even I guess nowadays, and it doesn't start. You go, oh, well, that's a surprise. I just had it serviced. Why is it what? So it's the same startle thing. And when people are less familiar with how it works, or that it's completely vulnerable because you weren't even running any kind of cybersecurity, you didn't have cybersecurity training in the organization, you didn't realize that you weren't insured or that the insurance doesn't help you with any of the response part of it. It's not evil surprise. It's a genuinely I'm startled that this is where we're at. Oh my gosh. We've had that plan sitting on the shelf for 3 years. We were the first in our industry with any cybersecurity plan. But here we are in the middle of the incident and we don't know who the team is. All we have is our IT team and they're now telling us they only exist to keep our computers running. They don't know how to deal with this. They can't tell me anything about the incident or how it occurred. Logs, they didn't know they expected us to keep logs. What logs? We'd need an algorithm the size of Everest to read the logs now.
So what happens then?
Companies that are specialists in this can earn a lot of money because it's very short notice and they don't have a pre-existing relationship with the client.
So how often is this happening? Look, give a percentage. Like, is this happening to more people than we like to believe out there? I'm assuming so.
Yeah, it is. And honestly, this is like those unreported statistics on, for example, sexual assault. I think the ones that we know about are the ones where, A, as I kind of hinted at with the ANU breach, they even know it's occurred. So it's almost great to get a ransomware because you know for sure it's occurred. The one that scares me more even than the unknown breach, the one that intrigues me because, you know, so many of the cyber criminals are very, very, very bright. The one that intrigues me the most isn't that they've just gone in and not been detected. It's where they've gone in and damaged the data and then just left for the hell of it. That one really disturbs me.
So, EJ, is there any sort of final thoughts or closing comments you'd like to leave our audience with today?
First of all, you're all amazing and I know you're all doing too much and this isn't an attack in any way. It's an invitation. It's not necessarily to call me. Feel free if you want to. Just read through what you have, whether you've got a business continuity plan, whether you've got a disaster response plan, whether you've got an incident response plan. Read it. Does it even make sense? Does it have points of contact or is it a template? Because I'm going to guess that if I threw a stick at half of the listeners, they've got a template in their organization and it doesn't even specify contacts or the organization. At the end of the day, what I want to do as a cybersecurity lawyer is I want to give you a defensible position after you've been breached. And I can't do that if you weren't prepared. I want to keep you out of court. I want you not to be the next litigation in Australia or anywhere in the world. So you first of all have to know what you must do, what's already law. And secondly, I want you to be in a position where you can defend what you did. Because in the case law we got last year, RI advice, they couldn't defend the position they were in. They had not done what a reasonable person in cyber security ought to have done.
Thanks for tuning in. For more industry-leading news and thought-provoking articles, visit kbi.media to get access today.
This is KBCast, the voice of cyber.